Work on the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, or DSM, began before the pandemic in the spring of 2019. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent. And the latest revisions were published just this month by the American Psychiatric Association. But so why does that matter? Well, it's the foundation for mental health diagnoses. It's the justification for research funding, and it's cited to process insurance claims. So what would you like to know about what's new? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation this hour. Always email available to you, ideas@WPR.org. Joining us once again, Arjun Rama, who is a psychiatrist specializing in working with young people, also a member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. Arjun, welcome back to the morning show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Lee.
Also joining us this morning is the editor of the current revised Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5-TR. Michael First is also a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I'll start with you, Michael. And I got to imagine being the editor of this latest version of this book can be downright daunting because of how important it is to the field of studies. So give us some idea, some perspective of what's in this book.
Well, it'd be helpful maybe to clarify how this book fits into the whole DSM line of over the years. So the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders published by the American Psychiatric Association, and it provides a diagnostic criterion, definitions, and information about all the mental disorders that mental health professionals treat. So the most recent major revision of the DSM, which was DSM-5, was released in 2013. So normally the number in the title gives you the major edition. So, but what this one is, DSM-5-TR, the TR actually indicates that this is primarily a text revision. Something like 98% of the words in the DSM is actually not the diagnostic criteria, which people use to make the diagnosis, but information about the diagnoses, things like prevalence, how they differential diagnosis, how it would look different in men versus women. So it's really an incredible wealth of information. And as you can imagine, that information could get quickly out of date. Constantly, you know, the information we know about mental disorders is constantly changing. So periodically, we want to make sure that the information in the DSM is as fresh as possible. So most of the work on the TR was to update the text completely. However, since DSM-5 came out in 2013, the criteria have also been revised, and a new disorder has been added since DSM-5. In fact, it just was released a year ago, and it's a new condition called prolonged grief disorder. So that's the kinds of, so most of what's in the TR is a text revision, and there are some very important changes with respect to the disorders and their definitions.
And Dr. Rama, how does this, to give us some idea of how this DSM-5-TR and the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, you use this in your work?
Absolutely. And I think Dr. First would agree with me. This is a book that codifies the issues that we're working with in terms of working with our patients. It's not a goal of ours to pathologize people so much as this is something that becomes a common language. It's a way that psychiatrists speak with each other. It's the way that also we can use the language involved in order to guide research. And then from a practical perspective, like you were asking about my practice, this is how I submit bills and this is how my patients are able to get their treatment compensated and paid for. So there are implications that go all the way from what we do in the office to what we're doing in terms of research and in terms of communication. So it's essential to, you know, every layer of practice.
So as a patient, Arjun, how does the DSM-5-TR updates impact what kind of care I can receive or do receive?
Well, in order to submit to an insurer, for example, it requires a diagnosis. As Dr. First had mentioned, we've added a new diagnosis in order to better capture the things that are actually happening to people. So as a patient, the reality or the element of this that's helpful is that by meeting the criteria for a diagnosis that's in the manual, we're then able to submit and be able to use it to make sure that your treatment gets paid for, which then can guide being able to have access. So that's the effect that I think can happen for patients. Understandably, I think people are also concerned, and I can understand why, about having new labels about things that happen to people. So it cuts both ways on that one. But I think ultimately, I think it'll be helpful for patients.
Also mentioned in Dr. First how the DSM can affect research funding for mental health. How does this play a part?
Well, research funding for mental health is certainly if a disorder is already in the DSM, that indicates that there's a pretty large prevalence of it, and it's very important. So things in the DSM, like the addition of this new condition, prolonged grief disorder, might encourage research funding to improve therapy. One thing I'd like to make a point for the listeners is that the DSM is extremely important for making diagnosis, but it says nothing about therapy. There's nothing about treatment in the DSM. However, what the DSM functions as is when you see a mental health professional and they open up the DSM to come up with a diagnosis, the diagnosis that they end up giving you, not only is it useful for billing, but it does tell the mental health professional what treatments are likely to consider. So, for example, this new diagnosis that's been added, prolonged grief disorder, it turns out that there's a specific psychotherapy that has been developed for this condition that has been shown to be very, very effective. So having this diagnosis, a mental health professional would then look up about this new condition, and they would see that there's a very specific therapy, and they would know to either do that therapy, or if they're not familiar with that therapy, refer the person to a clinician who is familiar with that therapy.
Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, also the editor of the most recent revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5-TR. Also joining us, Dr. Arjun Rama, psychiatrist specializing in working with young folks and is a member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. This is also a popular book. Michael, you wrote for Stat News back a couple years ago that each edition of the DSM sells over 1 million copies. Bureau of Labor statistics show there are barely more than 25,000 psychiatrists in the United States. Who's buying these books?
Well, that's an excellent question. So, first of all, mental health professionals of every type, so psychologists, social workers, psychiatric counselors, they all use the same book. So if you were to add that group of mental health professionals, you'd probably get up to maybe 200,000, but that still doesn't explain the 1 million copies sold. It's something that's purchased and looked at by students and also by family members and people interested in psychiatric diagnosis and interested in what kinds of conditions are out there. So we believe that the largest group of people buying it are actually not healthcare professionals, but families, patients, and people learning about mental disorders.
And so can a layperson open up the latest edition of the DSM and find useful information in it?
Well, I think so. For example, like I mentioned earlier about prevalence, if you're interested to know what is the prevalence of major depressive disorder, it gives it there and also gives you the information, not only to say what the prevalence is, but it explains that in different age groups, the prevalence might change or different parts of the world. So it's if you want to know that information, it's there and it's up to date. That's the most important thing. The reason we did the TR is we want to make sure that this resource, which is useful for both mental health professionals as well as patients and families, is up to date with respect to reflecting our current knowledge.
Dr. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, co-chair of the revision subcommittee for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, or the DSM, with most recent revision, the DSM-5-TR, out earlier this month. Also joining us, Dr. Arjun Rama, who is a psychiatrist and member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. And you're invited to join us as well if you ever page through the book used by psychiatrists, the DSM. And what were you looking for? Did it help you? And have you started mental health therapy during the pandemic? And share with us how that's helping. 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The newly revised Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, or DSM, came out earlier this month. It's a DSM-5-TR. And this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. Updates to the DSM include a new diagnosis, prolonged grief disorder. And as the New York Times detailed a couple of weeks ago, it's not without some controversy. So what questions do you have about the updated DSM, how we diagnose our mental health, and how psychiatrists work toward improving outcomes for their patients? Join us, 1-800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Arjun Rama is a psychiatrist and member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. Michael Furst is the editor of the most recent update, the DSM-5-TR, also a professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. And Dr. Rama, I'll ask you about this prolonged grief disorder diagnosis. What is it?
So prolonged grief disorder, this is a new diagnosis that really codifies what happens in terms of grief. This is something that has been worked on. Actually, it's not something that just sort of showed up, but there's been work on this disorder since decades ago. There's concern that people were having difficulty with the bereavement period beyond what would be socially or culturally expected. And it's especially appropriate now since we've had multiple catastrophes. I mean, think about COVID, gun violence, war. So it fits this current era. Grief after loss is expected. So the time course for prolonged grief disorder is really an important factor here. In terms of the time criteria, someone close to you will have had to have died at least 6 months ago for children and adolescents, or 12 months ago for adults. This is something that is new. I mean, previously we would treat anxiety and depression associated with grief, but not grief itself. But as we've learned, grief itself can lead to terrible outcomes like suicide. The general criteria for it would be like an intense longing for the deceased or preoccupation with the circumstances of their passing. And this is something that's really important, is that it has to impair your social, your work, or other areas of function. But even more specifically, the things to look for would be things that would be like emotional numbness or a sense of identity disruption, like this feeling of like part of me has died when someone has passed away. And then even like a disbelief about the death or avoidance of the reminders that the person is dead. You know, this would be like being unable to listen to the music that they like, the things that sort of strike you about them. Intense emotions after their death, like really intense feelings of anger and difficulty reintegrating with regular life activities, like being unable to get back into your hobbies, for example. So that's kind of a synopsis of the new disorder.
Yeah, and Dr. Furst, as you edit this new text revision for the DSM-5, give us some idea of how, what went on in, as the New York Times says, there's some controversy here, but the prolonged grief disorder diagnosis and including it in the update.
Like as was just mentioned, this is something that has been identified at least 20 years ago. And when the problem is, people who have this condition, if it's not in the manual and identified as an actual condition with a potential solution, people aren't looking for it. So if someone experienced the loss of a loved one and then a year later they're still caught up in it, somebody might say, come on, you're just wallowing in it, get over it already. This is actually a disorder that makes it clear that something has gone wrong in the grieving process. Like the symptoms that were discussed a month later after the loss, everything that was mentioned, emotional numbness, that's expected. But normal grief over time, you adapt to it and you move on. And the question is, how long should it take to persist for you to consider there's something going wrong? And the studies show that 12 months, if you're still in a serious, severe grief reaction that's interfering with your functioning, something has gone wrong, and that person really deserves clinical attention if they so want it. So that was the rationale for putting it in there. And as often happens, when we add something to the DSM, it's really done to try to help people get the treatment that they need.
Yeah, I guess in general terms, I think of the grief five stages that we are all told about that I can never remember. But for folks who are, it's been a pandemic and there has been loss, there has been trauma. But for folks who feel this sort of feeling, what would you say to them, Dr. Rama? How do they deal with prolonged grief disorder? Folks probably listening are like nodding their head along. And if they are, what do you say to them?
So, and this is something that I would say to everybody who's experiencing symptoms like this or symptoms that are adjacent, I think this is the time to get seen. And that's easier said than done. Local to us in Madison, I think that we have a crisis in terms of getting people in for intakes, ongoing psychotherapy, medication management, the whole deal. However, I think that this is not a time to hesitate, and this is not a time to view these things as, well, it's just normal. You know, life is difficult. We're under so much stress. I would say allow yourself, if you can, to avail yourself of resources to get an assessment done and to possibly get into some form of treatment. And in that way, you know, not even to get too preoccupied with the diagnostic criteria itself, but go by your feelings that something is not quite right, and to try and to get seen, maybe if even at first with your family practitioner, and then hopefully to get referred to a psychiatrist from there. So that would be where I would start.
Psychiatrist, we'd also like to hear from you this morning at 1-800-642-1234. What do you have to impart about your work, the update to the DSM, and what you are seeing out there? With our guests, Arjun Rama, who you heard there, psychiatrist who specializes in working with young folks, and Michael First, who is the editor of the recent update to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSM-5-TR. And Michael, the revised DSM also includes updates on suicidal behavior and something called non-suicidal self-injury. What are these updates?
Yes. So among the most, as you can imagine, as a mental health professional, among the symptoms and behaviors that are of most alarming is suicidal behavior, which is behavior that is specifically done with the goal of ending your life. Now, some people do things to themselves specifically not to end their life, but they injure themselves for some kind of emotional relief. So these are two very, very important symptoms. But they've not really, you know, like suicide's a good example. There are a couple of disorders that have suicide mentioned as part of their definition, but suicide could occur across virtually every condition that's in the manual. And the manual really wasn't allowing people to record when suicidal behavior is present, either in the past or the present. And it also is difficult to do research on suicide if medical records and databases don't actually indicate who is suicidal. So this was something that was added to really draw attention to these two very, very important symptoms that bring people into treatment.
I want to mention at this point that you are not alone. You are never alone. And there is somebody to talk to you at any time. The National Suicide Hotline is available to you at 1-800-273-8255. That number again is 1-800-273-8255. Arjun, as you look at the addition of non-suicidal self-injury, how does this help you in your work?
Well, it makes me think about the idea of quantifying, capturing this data in the context of what can only be described as a sort of second pandemic that's going on. And this speaks to the group of people that I work with most, which would be young people, young adults, and late adolescents. I am seeing so much more thoughts about self-harm and thoughts about ending one's life than I did prior to the pandemic. And in that way, I'm really glad to see that this is something that's being captured. And speaking to the previous point about, you know, what to do if we start to see symptoms like this is absolutely, this is like my PSA to young people is please do get seen. If you're part of the UW-Madison community in particular, which is where I work adjacent to, is to get in to be seen, because a lot of these things are happening secretly, silently, and they could be, foretelling much, much worse outcomes for folks.
I want to take your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to add your story about our mental health and, finding treatment, finding access. 1-800-642-1234. I'd like to go to Mark in Madison if we could, if he's available. Mark, you are on the air with Dr. Arjun Rama and Dr. Michael First.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, I would like to share something from my own personal experience. I'm, a white Caucasian living in Madison. And in 1989, I lost my daughter to a brain tumor. And succeeding that, I spent time with people from the Pine Ridge Reservation. They're Lakota. and they taught me some incredible, they gave me some incredible insights. One, that the grief process is basically 7 years of grieving and reintegrating into the community. But it takes that much time to be able to move through your loss and find connections again and find purpose for yourself within your community. And in adjunct with that, I did for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, sweat lodge ceremony, Lakota style. It was under the pipe of Elmer Running from Pine Ridge. And sweat lodge ceremony is an incredible experience. And every Saturday night for those years, I would go and sweat and sing my lungs out in this small turtle-shaped dome with steaming hot rocks.
Mark, I appreciate it. Does 7 years sound about right to you in terms of the grieving process?
Absolutely.
We'll get a response from our guest after the news. Mark, thank you for the call. I am sorry for your loss. But it is about healing as well, with Arjun Rama and Michael First joining us. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We're spending this hour looking at the way psychiatrists diagnose and treat our mental health. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer-Kent. And the latest update to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders was published earlier this month by the American Psychiatric Association. And it includes an acknowledgement of the role that racial discrimination has historically played in clinical diagnoses. It also adds an updated and more inclusive description of gender, because our understanding into our own minds continues to evolve. So what would you like to know from our experts about understanding race and gender, our identities, and our acceptance of them? 1-800-642-1234. We are joined by Dr. Arjun Rama, psychiatrist and member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association, Dr. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, and the editor of the recent revision to the DSM, the DSM-5-TR. I want to go back to the call we had from Mark before the news and get your reaction to the loss of his daughter from a brain tumor in 1989 and his grief process, and the Lakota elders who told him that it would take 7 years to fully grieve. And as we talk about the new diagnosis and the update to the DSM, the prolonged grief disorder, one of the things you did mention, Dr. First, is the cultural aspect of this.
Right. First of all, one misconception that people have about prolonged grief disorder is that it is true that 1 year is the point. If you're still, you have to have been grieving for at least a year to even qualify for the diagnosis. But some people construe that as meaning this: we think grief lasts only a year, and if you're still grieving at all after a year, then there's something wrong with you. Grief for some people can go on. I mean, 7 years is as the caller put in. Many people grieve the rest of their lives, especially if it's for a child or a parent. That's still normal. It's the degree of impact on your life. Is it something that's affecting you every day? That's what makes the grief in prolonged grief disorder considered to be evidence that something is going wrong with the grieving process. So but you make the point is that it is true that culturally there is this idea that, you know, when you come up with a number like 1 year, obviously that's somewhat arbitrary. Different cultures, there's a certain kind of norm for what's considered normal to grieve in one culture versus another. In fact, the International Classification of Diseases by the World Health Organization just came out with their 11th edition, and they also had prolonged grief disorder. And interestingly, they decided to use 6 months as the cutoff rather than a year. But they explicitly say that 6 months is just a kind of an arbitrary number, but what really matters is exceeding what's considered to be typical for the culture. So different cultures have different accepted levels of grief and different paces by which people deal with their grief and recover from it. So it's very important. In fact, this issue about culture is something that's extremely important throughout the entire DSM. Every diagnosis in the DSM in the text has a paragraph talking about how this disorder presents differently in different cultural settings. So culture is incredibly important for how mental disorders present. DSM really wants to address that.
Before we get back to the calls here at 1-800-642-1234, I want to ask you, Dr. Rama, about your work, which, as you mentioned, is adjacent to the UW-Madison, which would have a much more diverse population than in general the rest of the state. So how do cultural aspects play into your work?
Oh, absolutely. It's essential. And actually, just coming back to the caller, I was just thinking about how, in some ways, I think we as psychiatrists, as we try to codify things, in some ways, I think we're catching up to the way that religious groups and other ways of understanding grief have been describing for decades, centuries, millennia. And in that way, like you were asking about students at the UW, there's a intersection of folks from all over the world for whom the presentation of grief could be so different. I mean, there are some folks for whom, if you're coming from in cultures that come to mind to me readily, would be folks from East Asia. I think that grief may not be as spoken about or as readily as groups from other parts of the world. And in some ways, you could, as a diagnostician, as a psychiatrist, you could miss it if you were not familiar. So in that way, I'm really excited that the new revision is more sensitive, I think, to cultural components. That way, not only do we get the diagnosis right, we can therefore get the treatment right. We can get the assessment right. So the Madison community in particular is a group that intersects with so much of the world. And so these cultural elements really matter.
Let's go back to your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234, where Bill calls us from the North Woods. Bill, you're on the morning show with Dr. Arjun Rama and Dr. Michael First.
Excellent topic there, gentlemen. And it's just very remarkable how far things have come. And, Dwayne Rock Johnson has even suffered from some depressional issues. And I've seen some direct impacts myself with people that have family members with suicide. And, it's a very powerful thing. And, the grieving is sometimes you don't get over it. You just kind of learn how to deal, with it a little better. And just to, grab the line and give a call and just realize, people do love you. And, there's always a way out.
Bill, I want to thank you for that perspective. And yes, there are always choices. There are always options. And the National Suicide Hotline is available to talk anytime at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-8255. Bill, thank you for the call. Let's go to Amber in Milwaukee this morning. Amber, good morning. You're on with Dr. Rama and Dr. First.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I was just wondering about when it comes to, you're talking about the impact of like race and culture on the diagnosis, and I have biracial children, and my older son was diagnosed a few years ago with some mood issues, but then they also listed ODD, but the psychiatrist was hesitant to lead with that diagnosis because of some of the stigma and like negativity surrounding that. But then my younger son was just also diagnosed, but they led with that. And I know there's, just stigma and different negative connotations to oppositional defiance disorder. So I just was wondering if you had any discussion around that.
Dr. First, oppositional defiance disorder and the cultural aspects and the racial aspects of diagnoses.
Yes, I think it's very important to you need to always take into account the cultural setting of the individual who you're considering to make a diagnosis for, because if you look at oppositional defiance disorder in the actual definition, it's very, very clear that the oppositional behavior has to be more than would be expected, especially given the person's age. Two-year-olds are normally naturally oppositional. You wouldn't apply this diagnosis to a two-year-old because that's normal. As somebody gets older and older and they continue to have that behavior, having temper tantrums and getting themselves into trouble and not being able to go to school, that's when you would apply it. So the person's age and the cultural background needs to be taken into account. So in certain cultures, if in fact, because another thing that could happen with that is different, even though the child may be the same, the parents may have different levels of tolerance for oppositional behavior. So whether or not the child is brought into attention could depend actually on the cultural expectations of the parents. So culture is extremely important, and it's complicated. That's why essentially mental health professionals have to almost be experts in all different kinds of cultures to be able to understand what's normal and what's not, given that culture.
And Amber, just to be clear, why was the healthcare professional hesitant to diagnose your biracial son with oppositional defiance disorder?
And, honestly, I don't know if race was an issue, but in my mind, my children are in a district that's not diverse at all, but they were saying how it could limit the access to services and that they'd just be labeled as, like, quote-unquote bad kid or something like that. And so when my younger son went in and they led with that, I was like, but another psychiatrist here had other thoughts on that. So
I think Amber's bringing up a really good point that is even larger than the specific question, which is the ways in which I think our diagnoses, we are scientific about them, but we have to be cognizant as psychiatrists about the meaning of putting it down on paper, how it exists in the medical record, and how it affects outcomes at the school level or the occupational level. And in a way, I think, Amber, you're bringing up an issue that's something that I hope, as time goes on, we become more culturally sensitive, that we do not have to be so concerned about the effects that oppositional defiant disorder or other diagnoses, ADHD comes to mind also, about how people receive it on the other end when they read it. I think we've made movement, but I hear what you're saying, which is that your concern or the psychiatrist or all of you are concerned about how other folks are going to interpret it, and it's valid.
That the culture plays a role in how this diagnosis is seen by the rest of the world as confusing, as complicated as the rest of the world can be sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Our guest this morning, and Amber, thank you so much for joining our conversation. Arjun Rama, there, psychiatrist who specializes in working with youth, member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University, also the editor of the most recent update to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders used by psychiatrists around the world. And you as well at 1-800-642-1234. So there are changes to the language around gender in this revised edition of the DSM-5TR. Dr. Rama, what are those changes?
Well, one that comes readily to mind is that we are now using Latinx instead of Latino, Latina, in order to be more gender inclusive. What that conjures for me is a really exciting element to where psychiatry is now, because we are realizing that this is the world that we live in. We need to be more gender inclusive in order to recognize what's happening for people and to use the right language. I mean, I think that there are other changes that have become a part of the DSM that, multiple editions ago wouldn't have been thought of. I mean, Latinx usage comes to mind. We're also moving away from using words like race or racial. We're using racialized to denote that race itself is socially constructed. We've moved away from using the word Caucasian because that suggests a pan-European ethnicity that frankly doesn't exist. We have moved away from using words like minority, non-white, because if you think about it, those words position these groups in relation to a racialized majority, and then implicit in that is a hierarchy. So, I mean, if there's anything that's also exciting about the new DSM is that I think the language is doing a better job, or we're doing a better job with language in order to understand and describe our patients.
Arjun Rama there, psychiatrist and member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association. Also our guest this hour, Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the co-chair of the revision subcommittee for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, editing the most recent version out this month, the DSM-5TR. Still time for you at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. If you really want to think about it, and most of us don't, our physical reality, our shared reality, only exists in instants. There is only the now, right now, and the rest, our past and our future, well, that's just our imagination. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and while our physical reality only exists in the instant, being inside our own head can feel infinite. And I want to thank our guests for a fascinating hour of exploring our own infinite mind, how it processes our instance of existence, and how the experts continue to evolve in their comprehension of the human experience, which is absolutely unique for each and every one of us. So what do you still want to know about how we diagnose and treat our brilliant minds? 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Dr. Arjun Rama, psychiatrist and member of the Wisconsin Psychiatric Association, Dr. Michael First, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and the editor of the most recent update to the DSM, the DSM-5-TR. Ellen, I'm going to get to your question in a minute, but I also wanted to ask Dr. First about where we were before the break, and that has to do with the update to the DSM-5-TR that sees race as a social construct where Caucasian does not exist because we invented it and avoids other terms for racial segregation that would seem to imply a hierarchy. As you were working on this update, Dr. First, how did you take all these things into consideration?
We actually convened a special committee of experts in areas of discrimination and language and had them review the entire text of the entire DSM, looking for uses of language that might be problematic, like racist, you know, race is not a real concept. It's a social construct. And there's always the risk that when you, so like we have, I mentioned before about prevalence data, we do provide like what percent, you know, you're like depression. And we break it down sometimes by racial and ethnicity. And we were very concerned that somebody, if a particular ethnic group or racialized group had a very high prevalence, we were concerned that people might think, oh, it's because of their skin color, because of their race. When in fact, it's very often due to the way society discriminates against individuals like that. So the language has been added to try to add more nuance so people understand that when you race is a construct that we use, but how it actually affects mental disorders often has to do with social disadvantage and discrimination. So a lot of language has been added to sort of fill in how complex the picture actually is.
Race is something we created, so race is something that we can begin to undo to some degree as a construct or recreate?
Yeah, so I think the key is that, I mean, race is the, people use race for a reason, and it's embedded into our, the way we talk about things, but we just wanted to make sure that when people use race with respect to the issue of identifying and treating mental disorders, if they understand that you need to take into account how society's reaction to individuals with those racial labels are, and when you're trying to understand treatment and the occurrence of mental disorders.
Thank you for that. Let's go back to your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Ellen in Middleton, thank you for standing by. You're on the air with Dr. Rama and Dr. First.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, you know, I agree that that culture is a major factor in how we understand various psychiatric categories. But I was curious about how the consumer should approach all of this. You know, the average consumer may not be aware. Maybe they are. Maybe they aren't. You know, how factionalized the whole industry has become, and depending upon which door you enter. I mean, whether it's the psychiatrist or the psychopharmacologist or the therapists, is going to depend a lot upon how, you know, what treatment you receive and what diagnosis you receive, and which may or may not correspond to your actual condition. So how does the consumer, with or without, you know, months of research, go about approaching this whole industry and making sure that they get the right treatment?
Ellen, I wish I would have asked that question. Dr. Rama?
I think it presents a really difficult situation, Ellen. I was thinking about how we were talking about how it sounds like most of the DSMs that are out there in print are purchased by folks who don't practice, you know, but it's more out of wanting to educate yourself and understand what's happening. And in that way, I can understand that because these things are significant. I do think there's a certain amount of trust that goes in or would have to go in into seeing your providers of different stripes. Luckily, the DSM does extend past psychiatrists only. You were bringing up talking to therapists and folks of other stripes and persuasions in mental health. At this time, and maybe Dr. First could speak to this more than me, but at this time, this seems to be the language that we all use. And in that way, though, I think that it's it's exciting and a good idea to, if you receive these diagnoses, if you see them on, you know, your paperwork or things like that, I think that it's totally fine to look up the criteria and to speak to your doctor about it. I think that's being an educated consumer. So in that way, I would say broadly that this is the language of mental health professionals, not just psychiatrists. And I think wanting to know more about it and being educated about it is a valuable thing.
Ellen, thank you. And a follow-up here from Steve in Madison, who emailed us at ideas@WPR.org. He wrote in to say that in Wisconsin, is there any psychiatrist available with scheduling less than 6 months in advance at less than $500 an hour for those without applicable insurance discounts? And it goes back to access to mental health care and finding the proper channels and whether or not there is a limited access to mental health care. And Dr. First, I'd ask you broadly how you see access to mental health care right now.
Terrible. I mean, there's no question. I think COVID has made it worse. I mean, the what's happened is the number of people who really would benefit from either, you know, seeing a mental health professional has shot up, but the number of mental health professionals is the same, and it was always a problem in access prior to COVID. So it's really a very serious problem, and I think unfortunately the solution is partly, you know, society spending more in the government, spending more money and getting educating people, you know, therapists on how to do therapy, and also making the access, how do you find a therapist, easier to do. The system is really, really, unfortunately, quite broken with respect to being able to easily get the kind of help people need.
Dr. Rama, how would you approach finding the proper treatment for mental health?
Well, it's, you know, as that question was being read, or that statement, I mean, I had to sigh a little because it's absolutely true. We really are, so many of us all full up. The insurances are limited. And I would echo what Dr. First said, which is, I think this is, I hope, a rallying cry to us as constituents of our political leaders to lobby in order to get more funding. I don't think people realize, you know, I don't know the exact number, but I think it hovers around 10. You know, we don't graduate that many psychiatrists out of the UW-Madison, you know, per year, as many as people might think. You know, and in that way, you know, we can barely cover all the folks who are in need, and all those people who graduate, and they're excellent. Our candidates who come out of the program, they're full right away. So I have to lament that it's true that so much of us are really, really having a hard time fitting folks in, and please get on wait lists. I think that's the best way that I can say right now in order to get service. I'm sorry about that.
So there is a long-term solution, and that is finding the way to fund more schools for psychiatrists and psychiatry. But in the short term, get on the wait list right now, and that's what we can do. I want to thank you both for joining us this morning for a wonderful hour. Dr. Arjun Rama, thank you so much for your time and your understanding.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Lee.
Dr. Michael First, I want to very much appreciate you giving us the inside look to the update to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Health Disorders. Thank you.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss it.
I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent today, and you've been listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.